Sometimes in life, shift happens. A shift, which may be a blessing, a curse, or may be entirely non-impactful to your empirical world. Change can inherently, oftentimes, be scary or make you want to butt your head against the wall. But it can also be an event of celebration, a chance for restoration and newness. Shift your perception. This doesn't mean ignoring the bad in the world. In fact, I think that being knowledgeable about the ugly aspects of history is very healthy, not only personally, but also for society at large. What I mean by shifting your perception is to not dwell on what makes you angry, sullen, and hopeless. Sure, let yourself feel all of those things in their time, but then seek out wisdom, accountability, and constructiveness. I have found that what works for me amongst the noise of news reports and politics in the world is to set foundational principles as a basis to ground myself when the world becomes heavy. I can then take a breath, pause, and use discernment through my processing. And in my case, I use what I have processed to tell stories through my art. My guest in next week's episode, Joe Smith, talks about using our time, resources, and platforms to tell better stories. When you fight against the undertow, you only get pulled under and fizzle out quickly. He mentions to shift your focus and tell better stories rather than picking a fight that you will never win. Stories speak louder. Sally Murphy, an Irish cultural historian, in her 2022 TEDx talk, Why We Need Better Stories, says that by hearing her grandmother's stories, she found a key to unlock her own stories and to use her voice. And once that happened, it opened the door to allow others to do the same. She argues that sharing the diverse stories of the oft-forgotten figures on the sidelines is a more useful, inclusive way to look at the world and to envision an equitable future. She says, as we navigate this destructive new world, an increasingly digital new way of doing things, we have to keep issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion at the very forefront of everything we do. If we have the freedom of speech and the privilege of a platform of any size, then we need to use our voices to stand up and speak out for those people who are silenced. We need to actively make space to listen to all stories, to amplify a diversity of perspectives, and to be accountable to change. There's so much that we need to learn and unlearn so that we can do better, and this work can happen right now, in our homes, in our communities, in our workplaces, and in our hearts. One simple way to start is by telling better stories. Our words have the power to burn and destroy, or to build beautiful bridges of trust, empathy, collaboration, and belonging. We begin by finding our personal narratives, our strengths and our weaknesses, mapping, sifting, and sorting what made us. And then, if we should start sharing our stories, showing our hopes, our fears, our wins, as well as our vulnerabilities, then it makes it safe for other people around us to do the same thing. No matter what we do, we can each become a leader on this mission. And as we move and grow, we can consciously leave ladders in place for other folk to grow too. Symbols determine the kinds of stories we tell and the kind of history we make and remake. I want to be a place where people can tell diverse stories and the knowledge that there is someone there to listen. We have a job to do, not only to rock the system, but to make entirely new ones. To tell better stories so that we can make a better, fairer world. One that has inclusion, equity, and belonging at its core. The great Maya Angelou once said, "I come as one, but I stand as 10,000. In the future, the stories of our grandchildren will depend on us.
Fly tax and sheets.
We'll rant and we'll roar like true British sailors. We'll rant and we'll roar like true hearts of oak until we strike soundings in the channel of old England. From Ushant to Scilly is 35 leagues."
Stories have the power to illuminate, to allow us to learn principles and facts so that we can hopefully be more informed and a better version of ourselves in the future. History tells us what worked and what didn't work, and I can only hope that by learning the past, we don't allow it to repeat itself. For instance, let's go back to the Coal Wars between 1890 and 1921 in Appalachia and what is known as the Battle for Blair Mountain. Coal operators established towns where workers were paid in scrip, which is currency that can only be used at company stores within those towns. Because there were no other stores in town, prices were inflated so much that the miners had no choice but to accrue large amounts of debt, making it nearly impossible for them and their families to leave. Conditions became so bad that the miners attempted to unionize, but the coal operators started using union busing techniques, even as far as murdering men, women, and children to squash unionizing attempts. Miners would take up arms for decades, and there were conflicts between them. And slowly, over time, most of the miners became unionized. But between August 25th and September 2nd of 1921, 10,000 miners marched in protest against perilous work conditions, squalid housing, and low wages. On their way to meet coal companies on their own turf and demand redress, they clashed with nearly 3,000 deputized townspeople, business people who opposed their union organizing, and from local and federal law enforcement near Blair Mountain. Around 1 million rounds of ammunition were fired during this altercation, and 16 individuals lost their lives. After this event, union membership plummeted and attempts to unionize other mines came to a halt, which ultimately ended the Coal Wars. This whole event is well documented in the book Thunder in the Mountains by Lon Savage. He notes that they had been crushed and killed on their jobs and fired from them when they tried to organize a union. They had been evicted from their company homes and machine gunned in their union tents. Periodically, they had risen in fury. The events of this occurrence are still felt across Appalachia to this day. The biggest impact is that people do not trust the government, since the government sided with those who exploited the working class and the vulnerable. Because of that, many of the local economies and environments lay in ruin over a century later. There was a war that took place because of worker exploitation. And what resulted was a multiracial class solidarity uniting to confront the individuals who created toxic conditions by leveraging profits over people. You see, Brown v. Board of Education was decades away, and coal towns, like much of America, were segregated. But what makes this story so interesting was the agreed-upon understanding to put aside racial biases and create a community of mutuality and solidarity. Wilma Steele, a board member of the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum, says, "Metawan was one of the only towns in the United States where black and white children, most commonly Polish, Hungarian, and Italian immigrants, went to school together. Other miners were white Appalachian hillfolk. most all were kept apart in order to prevent organization and unionization. It didn't work. Chuck Keeney, a historian and descendant of key labor leader Frank Keeney, recalls one incident during the mine wars. Black and white miners held cafeteria workers at gunpoint until they were all served food in the same room and refused to be separated for meals. Keeney says, "We don't want to exaggerate it and act like they weren't holding hands around the campfire, but at the same time, they all understood that if they did not work together, they couldn't be effective. The only way to shut down the mines was to make sure everybody participated." In our current generation, racial tensions have reduced since a century ago, albeit still present. But the issue is more heavily weighed with the growing chasm between people on political ideologies and tribalism, left versus right, so to say. Much like how the coal miners were exploited for their productivity through middle and lower class, as well as the poor people in America, today continue to raise their voices against the exploitation of people and injustices from the wealthy. Just after the murder of Brian Thompson, the public started to wake up even to the inequality within our healthcare system, and Luigi instantly became a revolutionary figurehead to many. We have seen other names such as Aaron Bushnell, who, in an extreme act of protest, lit himself on fire to bring attention to the atrocities that Israel is committing and the American industrial military complex that is perpetuating it. Other individuals, such as Mahmoud Khalil, made headlines for being the first publicly known deportation effort related to pro-Palestinian activism under Trump, who threatened to punish students and others who aligned with terrorists. I should make it known that the word domestic terrorist, or eco-terrorist, came out in the 90s when environmental activists were engaging in direct action against corporations. On March 15th, Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia became the big headline as he was illegally deported from the United States in what the Trump administration called an administrative error, and then a clerical error. He was imprisoned without due process in the Salvadoran Maximum Security Terrorism Confinement Center, or CSOT for short, despite never having been charged or convicted of a crime in either country. He was sent there under an agreement to imprison U.S. deportees for payment. The Trump administration, despite admitting they did wrong, doubled down and dug their heels in by saying he will never touch American soil again, and repeatedly calling him a dangerous criminal, a terrorist, and an MS-13 gang member, of which all are allegations because he has never gone through any proper legal channels to dispute this. Trump has said that he has the power to bring him back and chooses not to do so. So what is he afraid of if Garcia was given due process? U.S. immigration policy, though, uses xenophobia and white supremacy to distract us all from the real threat to democracy, which is the bourgeoisie. Immigration laws and restrictions began with the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which initially put a 10-year ban on the immigration of Chinese laborers in the United States, but it remained in effect until 1943. There was a large influx of Chinese immigrants into the United States because, at that time, the Chinese economy had been devastated by British imperialism and the Opium War. They immigrated to America for the American dream, and many took on low-paying, menial labor jobs. Much of the same rhetoric we hear today was true back then. Immigrants stealing our jobs. Except no immigrant has ever stolen a job from anyone. The bourgeoisie, the wealthy owners, made a deliberate choice to hire people they could exploit more and pay less, cared more about profit than they did about human lives. In order to protect the skin on their backs and not accurately be blamed for injustices, they shifted the blame onto a convenient scapegoat, the immigrants they deliberately hired. Moving ahead to the turn of the century, the 1903 Immigration Act, also known as the Anarchist Expulsion Act, was passed because anarchists had a lot of influence and authority in the labor movement at that time. before the Red Scare around the time of World War I, anarchists and the labor movements were specifically targeted to maintain capitalist control. The bourgeoisie has two main tools that they use to maintain their wealth and control. The first is to limit the working class's ability to effectively and collectively organize. And the second is to distract us with a scapegoat. The problem isn't immigrants, undocumented or not, stealing your jobs. The problem isn't foreign terrorists coming in and trying to destroy our good, wholesome American way of life, even if that's what we're led to believe. Reverend Darrell Hamilton made a statement about being in solidarity with those underfoot by the empire. He said, "The gospel is meant for people literally under the foot of the empire, under the foot of Caesar, and for modern history, particularly our history, white folks are Caesar. What does the gospel mean for the Roman centuria? What does the gospel mean for people who worked for Pharaoh, who worked for the empire?" And so, for the Roman centurion to be able to then proclaim, "He is indeed the Christ. I worked for the empire. I worked for Caesar." But to still be able to make that profession of faith in who Jesus is now requires a change, a transformation of sorts. Not that you have to now act as if you are now living your life underfoot per se, but you would be living and functioning in solidarity with those who are. Good stories have the power to uproot systems of injustice. They stir something deep inside all of us, relating in the struggles. In a time when the bourgeoisie are attempting to tear down institutions of knowledge, let's tell more stories that inspire, stories that uplift, stories that bring us together rather than separate, stories that allow for diversity in thought and make room for a diversity of people, stories that are inclusive, stories that talk about the ugliness while inspiring us with hope, stories that move us. Carlos Whitaker puts it well by saying, "Curiosity leads to empathy. Empathy leads to trust. Trust leads to relationship. Relationship leads to change." Let's be the change by telling better stories and by letting shift happen.
4, 3, 2, 1, watch out, here I come. This is my time. I'm on the rise, can't hold me down, I'm too fly. This is my time, ready to shine, brighter than all of the lights. Cause when it's game time, seconds away and the game's on the line. There ain't no doubt in my mind, beating the buzzer like, this is my time.